Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council's Safety Committee looks more closely at transit security, even as the alleged murderer of Irina Zarudska is declared incompetent to stand trial. They were here, then they were gone. Now City Council considers bringing back red light cameras. Some are on board.
We must prioritize this.
Others aren't so sure. The mayor of Mooresville is still in the news, refusing to resign after a no-confidence vote on that town's board. He says he found Jesus.
I also found vodka.
A Japanese bank comes to town bringing 2,000 jobs. Mecklenburg County pushes back on attempts by the state to cap property tax increases, and the new Homeland Security chief promises to clear the massive backlog of hurricane relief funding for Western North Carolina. We hear about those stories and more from Nick Delacanal, host of WFAE's All Things Considered. He's here along with Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Mike. Welcome. Since last August, when Irina Zarudska was murdered on the Blue Line, a lot of attention has been paid to transit security. And this week, Charlotte City Council leaders focused on the safety plan presented by CATS. So, Joe, what are some of the highlights of that plan?
You know, they're making progress in having off-duty officers patrolling the light rail stations 24 hours a day. They have stepped up fare enforcement. They have stepped up security presence on the actual trains. They've done some back-of-the-house things in terms of de-escalation training and working with the FTA on some of their suggested protocols with how to handle security incidents and auditing of these type of training. But they still have some work to do, especially when it comes to payment verification and looking at a bigger picture, whether they want to have their own dedicated police force.
Although they say they are working on that payment verification, and they have an app, I think, in the wings ready to come out. We are spending a lot of time looking into safety on transit. There have been several audits, several investigations, a congressional hearing held here. But during this week's Public Safety Committee meeting, council's only Republican, Ed Driggs, said that despite the public's perception that transit may not be safe, those fears have been blown out of proportion.
I believe that the Irina murder was hideous and was also somewhat politicized and thereby heightened the apprehension that people feel about the system.
It should be pointed out, I think, that this murder, as heinous as it was politicized by Republicans, his party, at the state and federal level, right up to Donald Trump. And in February, the Charlotte Observer reported that crime is rare on public transit. Less than 1% of violent crimes that happen within a quarter mile of CATS bus or light rail routes or stops actually involve transit. And there has only been one murder on transit since 1970. Are we overreacting, Ben?
I mean, far be it for me to say that we're overreacting, but I do think that's why you're seeing a lot of these measures are customer-facing measures to make sure that people feel safe. You talk to any city leader and they'll tell you, even no matter what number you want to throw at people and say the stats here or violent crimes, 1% at some of these, rail stations, you want people to feel safe. And so you have a lot of these front end sort of measures like visible officers, customer facing inspection teams to address that. You also have fairness to our city leaders, tripled the spending. I think it's something like $10 million to $30 million when it comes to spending on safety. So is it enough? Is it too much? I'm not sure the number you can put on it when you consider crimes like that. The other stabbing that happened on the light rail do have a chilling effect. And you have a city that very much is invested for a variety of other reasons of having people take part in public transit. If they don't, it throws off the city's entire plan. So whatever it takes to make people feel that way, yeah, I think they're wanting to do it.
Perception is reality. Joe.
Yeah, I don't think we're overreacting. I think it was absolutely heinous that this poor innocent girl was just sitting scrolling her phone
and was senselessly attacked for no reason at all. And it's one of the worst things I've ever seen. And I think in many ways, we should have been having safety discussions about the train far before this incident ever happened. I mean, it was an open secret that security was never on the train, and it shouldn't have to take a innocent Ukrainian refugee being murdered on a train for the city to take public safety serious, because murders may not happen other than once in a rare moon, but other crimes, drunk and disorderly, people need to feel safe on public transportation.
CAT CEO, interim CEO, Brent Cagle was on this program last week, and we talked about this, and he said it's impossible to put a security officer on every single train car, and because you can't walk between the train cars like you can on a commuter rail or even a regular train, it would simply be unfeasible. But he has been making changes to make things more safe and to make passengers feel more comfortable. Because he agrees that perception is reality, and he says they have increased security. Have passengers noticed?
I think they have. I've certainly noticed that security is on board more often. They are checking for payment more often. They're proactive. You can go on the rail trail, and you can, you know, if you walk the stretch in South End, you'll see security guards near the platform or, you know, getting on the train or getting off it. I think they have stepped up. I think that now the next thing to think about is whether they want to have their own police force like Atlanta and Seattle and New York City. But there are certainly challenges with that as well in terms of law enforcement recruitment.
And that's on the books, but not for 2 to 5 years from now, that transit police force, Ben.
Yeah, I also want to say there's a sort of a backstory to all of this, and that is you mentioned how it got national attention, including the National Transportation Department. And I spoke to Dante Anderson. She's the chair of the City Safety Committee. I talked to her a few days ago, and she was quick to point out that the Federal Transit Administrator has given the thumbs up to the plan so far, which is important because, as we alluded to, we had the bond last fall. We have a huge sweeping mobility package that if it doesn't have the support of the national, you know, federal transit agency, then a lot of it doesn't happen. It's dependent on that. So to have the Fed say, hey, this looks good to us, goes a long way when it comes to city leaders and making sure this is satisfying not only riders, which is extremely important, but also the other side of that is making sure the feds, that they're satisfied by it as well.
Meanwhile, Nick, those who want to see justice served in the murder of Irina Zarudzka may have to wait a little longer in the state case against her alleged murderer, DeCarlos Brown Jr. A psychiatric evaluation found that he is incompetent to stand trial. Why?
Well, I do want to emphasize that this does not mean that a jury has found him not guilty, but it just means that doctors at this hospital believe that he is not mentally able to understand the charges against him. He's not able to work with his attorney, and so they've made the determination that he's not ready for trial. But I do think that it's important to say that it's not the doctors who will make that final determination. It will actually be the judge. So the next step would be a competency hearing where a judge will, you know, decide whether he actually can proceed.
Yeah, it should be noted that the psychiatrist's evaluation says he's not competent, but the judge has to make a decision, and they have not ruled on that recommendation yet, Joe.
And the judge can also issue an order to attempt to restore capacity, which essentially means like more mental health treatment, medication, trying to get DeCarlos Brown to a point where he is capable of standing trial. So, you know, I think when people saw the headline and, you know, that he's incapable to proceed, people's minds jumped to, oh, my gosh, charges are being dropped. You know, he's going to be released the next day. But in reality, this could still go on for 3 to 5 years. And we also have the federal case, which seems like that has to be resolved first.
And his attorney, a public defender, Daniel Roberts, has asked for a 180-day delay. Will that happen even if the judge doesn't rule that he's incompetent to stand trial? That will happen. You're not.
I think so. That delay is for a Rule 24 hearing, which is when the district attorney discloses whether they will seek the death penalty. So I think that it would be certainly way too soon to have that hearing as scheduled on April 30th, considering the motion that was filed.
Might this determination by a psychiatrist, Nick, might it impact whether or not the prosecution in the state trial asks for the death penalty or even the federal trial?
I think that's a good question. I think that, if anything, this really just kind of delays everything. It kind of just puts the whole thing on pause. I mean, and the whole thing with the court-ordered restoration, you know, that could be medication, or maybe he has to get some psychiatric care. And that, you know, like you said, Joe, that is a process that can take quite a long time. It could be months, maybe even years. You know, the legal system isn't really known for being great at treating people in these circumstances. So I do think that you do have to really have to, or you really do have to think about the victim's family here. You know, we talked earlier about how this case really was politicized, or it was really played up in the media. And partly because I think that this was so random and so gruesome, but, you know, this does mean that there's going to be a lot more waiting in the case. And you do have to think about the family. You know, you saw the mother of the victim actually at the State of the Union as a guest. So right. you got to remember, there are real people behind this case, and this means that justice might be delayed for them.
So from transit, we move to traffic. Once upon a time, Charlotte had red light cameras, but in 2006, a court ruling made the program financially impossible to continue because now, well, we'll talk about the ruling in a second, but now Charlotte City Council is considering bringing back those cameras. What precipitated this idea, Joe? Or Ben,
I think whichever one. One of the main factors, one of the motivations was the tragic death of Lance Sotillo, who was killed by a driver in outside of NOTA. And I also think that there's generally a perception that red light runners just are a plague in Charlotte. People have no regard for traffic laws in this city. And it has been a frustration for many, many years, many different councils. And now, because of guidance from the courts, it seems like if Charlotte wants to pursue red light cameras, they can. Because before, it was just always thought of as like not financially possible because of the law, the way it is written.
Yeah, the law says that you got to give 90% of, I think, your funding to the schools, to the CMS, and that makes it impossible to operate. It doesn't cover the operating costs. Sustain Charlotte says that running red lights has become a widespread problem, and that red light cameras could help. Charlotte City Councilman J.D. Mazurias, who represents East Charlotte, says it is a problem in his district.
These are things that we're seeing a lot in East Charlotte, a lot of traffic fatalities because of red light passes.
Do we have any figures, statistics on the number of people running red lights and causing accidents as a result, or even just running the red lights?
I do know.
I can tell you that. I can tell you that at least when they had them, it reduced crashes by nearly 40%, at least side crashes like T-bones and things like that. So when they had it in place, it did seem to be effective. Now, it didn't stop rear end crashes really at all, but at least those side angle crashes where you often have people running a red light, it did work in those until it didn't work and they stopped the program.
Yeah, I will say, Mike, it was a 20% decrease in crashes at intersections where this program was. I think it was like 40% on like the lanes where the camera is facing. But then the city did say that there was a 4% increase in rear end collisions in the lanes where the camera is facing. But then I think the question does become like, would you rather get into a rear end collision or get hit in the middle of the intersection at full speed, you know? Mm.
Several. We're going to talk a little bit more about this red light camera reconstitution because several members of council are on board, several are not. And we'll talk about why they might not be or might be on board with this and some other things as well, including a cap on property taxes. Good or bad? We'll find out. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Nick Della Canale, host of All Things Considered in the Afternoons here on WFAE. Joe Bruno is here from WSOC-TV. Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter, who we will hear from moments from now from the Charlotte Observer. And Ben Thompson is here. He's an anchor at WCNC-TV. We were talking before the break about the possibility of bringing back red light cameras, something that City Council is discussing at the moment. They were here, then they were gone, now they may come back. And several council members are open to the idea, but they are concerned about the costs. And one of those members is Republican Ed Driggs.
Not to put a price tag on injuries in human life, but I would ask myself, could we use that money in other ways for safety and save more lives than by this?
Could we? Are there other ways?
Well, I think there's always going to be other ways. I think this is in line with what the city honestly has talked about for years with Vision Zero. We haven't mentioned that yet, but I mean that's an ongoing program to get our traffic fatalities down to zero. So it is certainly in keeping with that. To Ed Drigg's point, I think that's part of where that 2024 court ruling comes in, is that it now says, well, money still has to go to school, but it can cover your operating costs, which make it a little bit more appealing to city leaders like Ed Driggs, who are worried understandably about the financial cost of this. We should also mention that we're not talking about every intersection in the city of Charlotte. We're talking about 10 intersections that tend to be problematic, that tend to have big problems, tend to have T-bones, tend to have red light runners in them, at a cost of about $600,000. So it's covering the cost of that, is what you're talking about.
Nick.
Yeah, and that is $600,000 a year for 10 intersections. So I think that's about $60,000 a camera per year, if you want to do the math. So I think there is a concern about costs on city council. One thing I thought was interesting was you even heard Kimberly Owens bring up the idea of maybe putting out decoys. So like fake cameras. She asked the city attorney about like subterfuge, I think was the word, to maybe like, fake people out, but still, keep the cost down.
There must be a problem on the east side, because we have two council members from the east side who wants these cameras up. We've just heard from one. Dimple Ajmera is the other. She's an advocate for bringing these cameras back.
But I think timing is critical, because the longer we wait, we are going to see more lives lost to traffic fatalities. So we must prioritize this.
So Vision Zero, I think, Joe, you mentioned this. Vision Zero calls for taking our traffic fatalities to zero by 2030. That's, by my calculations, not very long. As I understand it, council has two options should they decide to bring these cameras back, and one is quicker than the other. They could dip into those funds set aside for Vision Zero to get the program up and running quickly, or they could go to the General Assembly to ask for help, which would take longer. This was under discussion by the Public Safety Committee. Did they seem to take a position on which path they might recommend to the full council?
I think it's still early to say that the city council has decided which path they definitively want to pursue. The General Assembly has, Vicki Sawyer is big into transportation, very influential. She represents Mecklenburg County. She has she passed legislation last year that would allow speed cameras in school zones. So the General Assembly has passed camera-friendly legislation. But the city council really has this authority already. I don't think they should rely on state funding for this. If this is something they want, this is just something they have to decide whether, reducing the amount of red light runners is a priority for them. And it might not be, but I don't think that, pulling CMPD officers off of their beats to, ticket drivers or just sit at intersections waiting for them is it necessarily a good use of their time either. So if they want to cut down on red light runners, this is probably their best solution.
Let me bring Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer into this conversation because the property taxes have caught the attention of the General Assembly. We've heard rumors, at least in this area, that maybe we need a property tax increase because of rising costs. But the General Assembly is considering a move that may limit local government's ability to do that. What are they considering, Mary?
Yes, so there is a bill in the legislature right now that would authorize a statewide referendum, which, if it passed, would instruct legislatures to cap annual property tax increases from cities and counties. Still in committee, so not officially yet, but if it does get fast-tracked in the short session, could be on the ballot as soon as November. And that's of big concern for Mecklenburg County because, as you alluded to, they're already heading into what's likely to be a pretty tricky budget cycle.
Mecklenburg County Manager Mike Bryant told the county commission this week that if this measure passes, the county would not have the flexibility to respond to challenges as they arise. And right now, property taxes account for 64% of county revenue. What impact might that cap have? Would it cap it at 64%? Well, what would it do? Do we know?
So we don't have a ton of specifics yet. There is currently in state statute a cap on how high property taxes can go. It's $1.50 per $100 of property value. Mecklenburg County's current property tax rate is only about a third of that. So if this sticks to that number, there is some wiggle room. But like you said, I think the county's perspective is that if something does come up in the future that triggers a bigger need or something unexpected, they won't have that flexibility. And to zoom out a little bit, this also comes at a time when the county is expressing a lot of frustration with the state about the lack of funding they're providing for Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools and other things like that. You know, the state, the word phrase of the year from the county commission has been unfunded mandate. And they seem to think that this sort of plays into that, that the state and the federal government, for that matter, are asking the county to take on more and more responsibilities, pay for more and more services and to the community without giving them what they need, the tools they need in order to pay for it all.
Yeah, we have a Republican legislature and an all-Democrat county commission. So you know there's going to be disagreement. And there was significant disagreement over this, not only from Michael Bryant, who's not on the commission, he's the county manager, but from Susan Rodriguez McDowell and the chair of the county commission, Mark Jarrell, and George Dunlap. What, do you have some of the things that they said about this idea at your fingertips?
Yes, yeah. So the phrase, Mike Bryant earlier in the conversation had stressed that he was, quote, not pushing the panic button yet, which led Susan Rodriguez McDowell to use the phrase, she is pushing the outrage button, her words, not mine. And, you know, board chairman Mark Jarrell got very, very intense about this. You know, he said that the county is frankly tired of being pushed around by the legislature when they try and go about things nicely, and that they're willing to take a much harder line on this. The county does plan to issue a statement to legislators urging them to vote against this measure. There's going to be a joint meeting next week with the city and CMS to talk about strategy for opposing this. But Mark Jarrell said he wants the county to go further than they have on past issues. And this feels like a hill that they're willing to die on idiomatically.
And he says it's time to stop tiptoeing around these situations that what are, in his words, unfair, inequitable, and unjust, and stop bringing a knife to a gunfight. This sounds like what Democrats are saying nationwide about certain policies being enacted. We'll see what happens. Seems like they're maybe tilting at windmills in a Dillon rule state. 2 years ago, Mooresville Mayor Chris Carney was discovered pantsless wandering around City Hall up there late at night. It has stirred up some controversy and some lawsuits from three former town employees alleging they faced retaliation after reporting this incident. And on Monday night, the town board in Mooresville held a vote of no confidence in the mayor, and they called for his resignation. Ben, what was Mr. Carney's response?
So this, we should say, is largely ceremonial, largely symbolic, largely political. They can take a vote of no confidence all they want, but they can't force him to resign. And his response in an interview with WCNC Charlotte was, I have heard from so many people, and there's been such an outpouring of texts and phone calls and emails, I'm not going anywhere. He said that Monday night. He reiterated that again in an interview earlier this week.
He did, however, apologize.
In hindsight, what this has done for our community, I am truly sorry. What it's done to my family, my wife, my children, I would change this a million times over if I could.
The most serious allegations, of course, involve those of possible retaliation against people who reported this. One town commissioner said it had, quote, impacted our brand, eroded trust in the town leadership, and the mayor had something to say about that, too.
If I in any way had anything to do with the people who are not employed here, I promise you I'll happily resign. If I have anything to do with that night having to do with that. But here's where we've gotten out of place on this conversation. This has just been good old-fashioned, ugly politics.
Is there any way to prove that he did or did not have something to do with the people who those people losing their jobs? Joe?
I guess we would have to know what his communication with the town manager and the town attorney look like. That will all come out in the all of the lawsuits that are involved. The town of Mooresville, you know, from the staff perspective, you know, this kind of all centered around the refusal to release this surveillance video to David Hodges at WBTV, and they kind of dug in.
It's hard for you to say that, wasn't it?
I love David. I'm wondering if a lot of if the town is also looking at the way they responded to this initially, if they're looking at ways that they could have steps that they could have taken that maybe would have not resulted into snowballing into this situation right now.
Well, he says he won't resign, but would a court, if these three lawsuits go to court and they find in the favor of the plaintiff, could that impact that decision not to resign?
I suppose. He says he's not going to run for re-election. So are these lawsuits going to be resolved by the time he leaves office? I'm not sure. But in terms of being removed from office, he will either have to resign, move out of the city, or pass away.
Ben.
Yeah, there could also be a recall election or some sort of legal action through the courts beyond what the three lawsuits are. But it certainly does increase the pressure and could make it, through evidence that comes through the lawsuits, an unsavory final 19 months of his term.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Carney, who has said on TV that he can't believe how this incident has gotten so much attention, did say that the controversy has helped him and put him on a better path.
I was able to get myself in a way better place. And I am as healthy and I'm as clear-headed as I've ever been in my life. And I'm thankful for that. And it's so interesting because somebody stopped me one day on the road and said, well, how did you find Jesus? Man, I found Jesus. Problem, I also found vodka.
Okay. If that political explosion in Mooresville wasn't enough, Nick, there was an actual physical explosion there that happened at an industrial park this week. It left one person dead. What happened?
Yes. Well, what we know is that there was a tanker truck that was arriving at a beverage manufacturer around 7 a.m. on Tuesday. And apparently this truck was carrying a highly corrosive cleaning chemical called sodium hydroxide. It was actually leaking for about 20 minutes before it exploded, according to investigators. So that blast killed the truck's driver, and it seriously injured a worker who was nearby. And now we do know that there is a federal investigation, so the NTSB has gotten involved. I think that does signal that there are maybe some bigger safety questions about this investigation beyond just this being like a single incident. So the company Carolina Beverage Group has actually had a couple of safety infractions in the past. I don't think anything major, but we will get a preliminary report in the next few months and maybe a full explanation a little while later.
Okay. It's time for a quick recap now of where we stand with the I-77 toll road plans. There was pushback to NCDOT's original plan, so they opened a location uptown where people could go, see the changes plotted out on maps, and comment and ask questions. But on Monday night, NCDOT presented updated plans to City Council. What's in these new plans?
So, you've got some noticeable, tangible things that I think will help some people. It certainly will not go enough for a lot of people. You've got a toll rate cap. You've got free rides for HOV users, which some assume that would happen anyway. But I think the more important one that would address what a lot of people, one of the biggest criticisms of this project has been, is that you would get discounts for low-income residents. One of the biggest sort of
how are you going to do that when the transponder that comes from NC QuickPass is also being used by other toll systems around the country? How would that transponder know that you are a low-income resident? And it costs money to get the transponder.
Yep, it does. Although now available this week, starting at Publix, we learned that. I think you could tie it to, you know, a person's, you know, tax information and things like that. I don't know exactly how you're going to do it, they're going to implement it, how they're planning to do that. But my point is that goes against one of the biggest attacks against these toll lanes, is that they're for people who are upwardly mobile, and they're taking away homes and neighborhoods from folks who will not use these toll lanes.
Sustain Charlotte is an organization on the front lines of the opposition to these toll lanes. Meg Fensel is with that organization. She says the pushback has given the city an opportunity to think deeply about the way they want to grow and share ideas in a way that's helpful and healthy. And she reiterated a major concern of neighborhoods on the west side likely to be impacted by whatever plan is decided upon.
We know the harm that the construction of interstates did to our neighborhoods when they were built. They cut off a lot of predominantly Black neighborhoods from each other and from uptown. And we don't want to repeat that same error.
But she also mentioned that the feedback they've been receiving at Sustain Charlotte focuses less on cars.
So we've seen some focus on public transportation instead of single occupancy cars or just creating more asphalt. We've also seen a lot of ideas that incorporate green space and public space for people to gather.
But Nick, the bottom line here is that this is a project to ease traffic flow on a major interstate highway, which was designed for cars and trucks and buses. Is focusing on buses and green spaces and gathering places practical in the framework of an interstate, which is clogged every day, 24/7?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think that there is maybe a gap in what the public imagination is thinking of, at least with the people submitting ideas to Sustain Charlotte, and what is maybe realistic as far as the state is concerned. But I do think, you know, Sustain Charlotte has been collecting these ideas from the community for like alternative designs. I think that community engagement is good, and try to get people thinking about other ways to think about this project. I do think I am interested to see some of these ideas, because they said that they've gotten ideas from preschool classes all the way to professional architects. So I think there will be a range of visions to sort through.
To put it mildly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have 10 seconds, Ben. Go ahead. 10 seconds.
Hey, any negotiation, now is the time to get what you want out of it. Now is your time to get your pound of flesh. If you don't do it now, you're not going to get it.
That's it. Well, a couple of celebs came to town this week. Mark Wayne Mullen was here this week. So was Destin Hall, not a dorm at UNC Chapel Hill, the actual Speaker of the House. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. We're here with Nick Della Canal, host in the afternoon of All Things Considered on WFAE. Joe Bruno's here from WSOC-TV. Ben Thompson arrived earlier this morning, and he's still with us, despite all of the things I've done to make him want to leave. He's an anchor at WCNC-TV, and Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter at the Charlotte Observer. Nick, former Senator Mark Wayne Mullen has taken Kristi Noem's place at the head of the Department of Homeland Security, which also oversees FEMA. She was criticized for micromanaging funds, which slowed a lot of recovery efforts down in Western North Carolina and elsewhere. He has promised to reverse that. And this week he came to Chimney Rock to see the wrath of Hurricane Helene. What did he see after all this time?
Well, he made a stop. He was touring damage in Chimney Rock and some other nearby places. So this was like very much like a boots on the ground kind of visit. I think that these visits are often just about visibility, so kind of showing that the federal government is paying attention, especially with this new secretary coming into the role. As you mentioned, the previous secretary, Kristi Noem, did get a lot of criticism, even from members of her own party, for the slow pace of some FEMA funds. I think that she had a rule where every expense over, I think it was $100,000, she had to like personally sign off on, so that kind of created sort of a bottleneck. So he, the new secretary, the nominated one, Mark Wayne Mullen, says he's getting rid of that. So hopefully that will speed things up.
He was joined, Mark Wayne Mullen was joined by Senator Ted Budd, North Carolina senator, and Representatives Chuck Edwards and Tim Moore. He told folks at the Chimney Rock Volunteer Fire Department that he believes, quote, that when we step back and we have an awful disaster like this, it is also allows us to be more efficient and more prepared. Was he talking about FEMA or was he talking about local officials in that statement?
Maybe both. I'm not sure. But, you know, it is sort of a reminder, you know, disaster recovery doesn't end when the headlines fade. So I think that this, you know, visit is sort of a reminder of that.
And he also said that his top priority at FEMA would be to clear the backlog of recovery funding.
What we want to make sure is that it's taken care of before the next hurricane happens, because the chance of us having two seasons in a row without a hurricane happening just isn't very likely.
I don't know. We've had a lot of those recently. We'll see. Hopefully he's wrong. We won't have a lot.
Fingers
of
crossed.
A Japanese bank announced that they were expanding into Charlotte this week, bringing a substantial investment and a lot of jobs with them. Nick, what bank? How many jobs?
Yeah, so the acronym is SMBC. I had to practice it a couple times before I had to say it on air. It's kind of a tongue twister, but they are bringing 2,000 jobs. These are very high-paying jobs. It's like $165,000 a year on average. And I think that this is a major win for the city. This sort of reinforces Charlotte's identity as a major banking hub. So I think we have to call this an economic win.
Governor Josh Stein was in town for that announcement, and he wanted to emphasize the number of jobs that SMBC is bringing.
Just in case the folks didn't hear that in the back, that's 2,000 good-paying jobs, $50 million investment.
And those jobs, as you said, 165,316 on average, a mix of executive, middle management, associate, and analysts roles. But Charlotte did have to kick in some incentives. Ben, how much money are we providing?
$74.5 million over 12 years. Not nothing for sure. But we did beat out Jacksonville with those incentives. So that's good news. And I should say, it's been quite the spring so far. I mean, it was 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, that Capital Group announced that they were coming here. Fewer jobs, but 600 jobs. And that average pay was like right under $200,000. Mm-hmm. So it's been a pretty strong, you know, few weeks for what's already, you know, one of our biggest industries.
So SMBC made the wise decision of avoiding Jacksonville and coming here. Their other headquarters.
Can you blame them?
Their other headquarters, my uncle lives there, so yes, I can blame them. Their other headquarters is in New York, and Hiro Otsuka is the CEO of SMBC America. He says they plan to stay.
This is a significant long-term commitment, one that reflects our confidence in this region and our plan to build lasting roots here.
So where will this headquarters be? When does all this begin?
Well,
because they have a presence here already, I understand.
That's right. They've said that the new headquarters are going to be somewhere in Uptown Charlotte, so we don't know exactly when. I'm not actually entirely clear on the timeline.
Okay.
Through 2032, I think, is the hiring between now and the next 5-6 years is what they've said.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay. So this area is continuing to grow. And in response, UNC Charlotte announced plans this week to launch a school of instruction or construction.
When there's a challenge this big, UNC Charlotte does what it does best. We build a solution. As one of the country's fastest growing construction markets, Charlotte is exactly where that solution belongs.
That's UNC Chancellor Sharon Gaber. She says there is a critical need for construction professionals here. What kinds of needs will this Albert School of Construction fulfill, and how does it differ from the engineering courses they already teach there?
Well, they've actually said that this is a very unique program in that they're going to train students across the entire construction process, which is, I guess, what the industry is increasingly asking for. So they're going to have courses on everything from planning and design to actual methods and execution and delivery. And they say that that is like a first of a kind program in North Carolina. And I think during this announcement, the officials had said that there was something like a $2 billion in construction planned across Uptown and South End and beyond in the coming years. So I think that there is a recognition that, you know, there is a lot of growth in Charlotte, and maybe we don't have enough people right now to actually build all of it. And so the idea is that this school will really help that.
I mentioned earlier that North Carolina Speaker of the House, Destin Hall, was scheduled to be in Charlotte yesterday to speak to the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance. I think he did come, Joe. What did he have to say?
It wasn't particularly a newsworthy visit. No offense to the speaker. But, the Alliance, I also don't want to discourage them from doing this because they have these events every quarter with, you know, newsmakers, and they bring in people to talk to the Business Alliance and the media. And Destin Hall just kind of gave an overview of the session. I guess the most newsworthy thing he said is that he expects a budget to pass relatively quickly when they get back in the session. And he told Stephanie Sneed, the CMS board chair, that he thinks that they can take significant steps in terms of teacher pay.
Is the budget going to get passed because of the lame duck status of Phil Berger in the Senate? Is that what the deal is? Did he talk about that?
I think that probably has something to do with it. Maybe negotiations look a little different now. I don't know where they landed in terms of the debate over the corporate tax rate and also the children's hospital funding, though, that they're looking for in the Senate.
Okay. Mary, perhaps you've heard there is a Senate race in North Carolina, a rather important one, pitting the former Democratic Governor Roy Cooper against former Republican National Committee Chair Michael Whatley. You report that both candidates are talking about high prices. Are they offering a method to bring those prices down?
Somewhat, yeah. So sort of the opening salvo of the Cooper campaign has been a plan they've branded Make Stuff Cost Less, includes a number of proposals related to healthcare and energy costs, as well as just everyday essentials like groceries. Former RNC Chairman Whatley has also been talking about this issue a lot. He hosted in one of his first campaign events post-primary here in Charlotte, an event on affordable housing. He was joined by Congressman Tim Moore and the federal HUD secretary for that. I believe also hosted an event in the Raleigh area last night with South Carolina Senator Tim Scott focused on this issue. So definitely something that both campaigns have been trying to put a lot of focus on and what's likely to be a very consequential issue with voters.
Well, now Donald Trump, who has endorsed Michael Whatley, has said affordability is nonsense, essentially. I'm paraphrasing here, but he said that. And the prices that have gone up since last year have gone up under policies administered by the Trump administration, from tariffs to the war in Iran, which is increasing gasoline prices. Is this a dangerous topic for Michael Whatley to run on?
The political experts I talked to said it will likely be a tricky area. This was really a winning issue for Republicans back in 2024, but the tide seems to have turned a little bit. As you mentioned, you know, prices are still not where consumers want them to be. The latest inflation numbers out this morning, which are obviously heavily influenced by the conflict in Iran, are not what the administration was hoping for. So certainly a bit of a quagmire there for Republicans who have been able to win on this issue in other past elections, but in 2025 and headed into 2026 appeared to be losing ground on it a little bit. You know, I asked Whatley about this at that event back in March here in Charlotte, and he said that the Trump administration is still working to undo what the Biden administration did. But, you know, the political experts I talked to said, you know, that's a line that's likely to get old with voters pretty quickly.
Yeah, we're over a year into this now, so he owns it. The Trump administration owns this now. But can either of these men, Roy Cooper or Mike Whatley, win the Senate race? Do they have any power, any ability, any means to lower costs?
I mean, to an extent, yes. I mean, to be one of 100 senators is a relatively powerful position. You influence things like federal tax code. You influence, you know, Washington's position on things like healthcare policy, energy costs, and things like that. So it certainly is consequential for these issues. You know, the decisions that come out of Washington do have a very direct impact on what we pay for, just everything you have to pay for in daily life.
Yeah, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what Democrats are hoping for, is by a seat like, you know, Roy Cooper's, if he were to win it, and a few others, that they can knock off a few Republicans. And then, yes, somebody like a Roy Cooper or a Democrat in another state who beat a Republican can have quite a say because they'll have a majority in the Senate.
Well, this U.S. war in Iran is doing nothing to bring prices down. On the contrary, oil and therefore gasoline prices are rising and will likely stay high no matter what happens for months to come because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the backlog of ships that are trying to get through that. It will take months for the oil supply to stabilize. There has been this shaky ceasefire in place, narrowly holding, but Iranian citizens have been suffering as a result of the war, and we have an Iranian community, Nick, in Charlotte. WFAE has spoken to a few members of that community. What are we learning from them?
I think that what we're hearing is just like a real sense of uncertainty right now. So, you know, even with this ceasefire in effect, I think the big question is, what comes next after this? You know, this moment really is sort of about the future of Iran as a country and what kind of government or stability or instability might come after this. And I think that there is also sort of a tension here where you have people who oppose the current Islamic regime, but who are also wary of outside intervention and the instability that can follow.
Yeah, Sharam Missouri is one of the people that we spoke with. He's among the 10 to 15,000 Iranian Americans living in this area. He's been here for 5 decades, and he says that regime change is necessary.
The regime has to go by any means necessary, because if we don't get rid of this Islamic regime, this kind of terrorism bullying is going to continue.
But he adds that this ceasefire will bring only temporary relief.
What's going to happen after 2 weeks of ceasefire? Are we going to get back to bombardments and such? Or, you know, what is the end result?
And he also says he's in constant contact with his family in Iran. Did he share anything about their reaction or opinions about the U.S. efforts there from his family living still there in Iran?
Not to my knowledge. So Okay. That was another reporter who worked on that story. But I will say that I think that hearing those voices does just kind of bring this into focus. You know, this is something that's happening overseas, but this does have a real impact here in our Charlotte area. People do have family members there. They are watching this closely. And I don't think that this ceasefire really eases everyone's anxiety.
Mary, Mecklenburg County has a couple of community resource centers operating in West and East Charlotte, and they're considering opening 3 more. But you report that some members of the commission believe, the county commission, believe that money could be better spent elsewhere. First, what do these centers function as? What do they do?
Yes, so these community resource centers bring together a bunch of different county offices, and they also have a lot of space for some nonprofits to set up shop. The one in East Charlotte has the food bank. So the idea is sort of concentrate a bunch of stuff that people need in one place so that they can sort of go to one building and get a bunch of stuff done at one time rather than having to run around town to a bunch of different offices.
And have those centers been successful?
So attendance did decline sharply during COVID for obvious reasons. Almost in-person services were shut down. At the facility that was open before COVID, numbers have not quite gotten back up to pre-COVID levels, but have rebounded somewhat. And then the newer center over in East Charlotte, is attendance is slowly growing and starting to approach the levels that we're seeing at the older facility on the west side.
So when will they make a decision about whether or not they're going to build 3 more of these?
Yeah, so this is a longer-term discussion. This is actually part of a broader discussion about whether to reassess the county's sort of rolling 5-year plan for big construction projects. But the conversation about the community resources specifically was really centered around whether sort of 2 is enough. And whether the idea that, you know, when county commissioners are out talking to the public, they hear a lot more interest in more recreation centers and community resource centers, whether it's possible to come up with kind of a hybrid model, a recreation center that incorporates some of the services that you would see at a CRC.
So I only have a couple seconds here, but I want to give you an opportunity to lick your wounds, because I know you are a graduate of USC and the Gamecocks, the Lady Gamecocks. Gamecocks lost their shot at the national championship last week. Anything to add to that?
Yeah, you know, UCLA had a heck of a team. Corey Close is a really cool person. Cool to see her finally get her natty, and excited to see 3 Gamecocks drafted into the WNBA in a few days.
Meanwhile, the Hornets are jockeying for position. It keeps changing with every game in the NBA, Joe. Where are they today? They're jockeying position to either be in the playoffs or the play-ins.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited about the Hornets. They're going to be in the play-in. It depends on the seeding. Joel Embiid on the Sixers had to get his appendicitis. So their best player is now out. So maybe that gives the Hornets a leg in this stretch to improve their seeding and hopefully bring us back to a playoff series for the first time in a very long time.
Very long time.
Go.
And there are two games left in the season, so we'll see what happens. But a lot of teams involved in all of this. Joe Bruno has the last word. WSOC-TV, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV, and Nick Delacanal, host in the afternoon of All Things Considered on WFAE. Thanks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.